Let's turn right to Las Vegas, which has become the scene of the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history.
The entire country is still in shock over this massacre in Las Vegas.
The investigation into the Las Vegas shooting is in the early stages, and already there's a debate over whether to call this crime an act of domestic terrorism.
Nevada's Governor Brian Sandoval said it is hard to understand what's happened.
I don't know if I have words to describe what we're going through and what these poor, unfortunate victims are going through. We're angry, we're grieving, we're confused. People are hurting.
It's all news about the same event, but as we've just heard, it's been covered in many different ways, from a massacre to the worst shooting in modern U.S. history. President Trump called it pure evil. As we slowly move from grief to healing, and with any hope of change, are we even talking about the same thing? I'm Matthew Law Middleton, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we're exploring how we talk about these kinds of events. And later in the hour, we'll discuss how we talk with children about active shooter training. But joining us to help us understand the way we talk about things is Phil Duncan. He's a linguist at KU and teaches language and culture in society. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So as we heard, the shooting in Las Vegas has been described as the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Do you have a reaction when people use the word worst to describe an event?
Well, language sort of has a life, and that's sort of an interesting fact about how language works is we typically think about it as words, but it's more than words, and it has sort of a social life of its own. And oftentimes, the way we phrase something involves specific choices. And sometimes when we say something, it also silences other ways of looking at it. And worst is one of those that oftentimes is very specific because it's an evaluative type word, but it oftentimes will silence other particular views on something like a mass casualty, for example. So when people talk about an event today, oftentimes in the past, that means we ignore or silence other things that have happened that are very deep and important issues and events.
So what are you concerned about being silenced in this case?
Well, I guess, and I wouldn't want to necessarily position myself as representing anyone else, but a lot of discussions that I've heard, for example, have to do with, and today is Indigenous Peoples Day, so it'd be remiss maybe to not to mention something along these lines, but a lot of Native American communities have reacted negatively against using a superlative like worst, especially even in conjunction with the term like modern, because both of those tend to ignore and silence and follow a trend where we actually do ignore and silence violence against Native Americans.
Oh, so like, because of course and from that perspective, the worst mass tragedy shooting would of course be like perpetrated against Native peoples in and around the Americas.
Exactly.
Is that dangerous in your mind? Like when you think about these things, do you think about them as like, oh man, I'm concerned, or do you think about them with a kind of different emotional reaction?
I would say it's a mix. It's complex. I mean, there is a bit of concern because the way that we talk about these things can definitely shape the way that we think about them, and it can affect how we construct narratives. It can affect our collective memory, because it's not just about words, language itself is social action, so it has real-world effects. So in that sense, yes, I am concerned, or do express concern, of the way that we talk about things because of the impact that it has in people's lives and in communities.
Yeah, when you said that, it made me think of this philosopher, Slavoj Žižek, who said just a few years ago, words are never only words. They matter because they define the contours of what we can do, like what is possible. Do you see the words that we're using around this event limiting or expanding what we think is even possible?
Well, I guess the way that I've typically thought about some of the ways that news coverage or other people talk about this has focused more on limiting what's possible. So the debate on whether or not to call something like this terrorism, for example, part of the import of a phrase like words aren't just words in the way that the way that we talk interacts with other things has to do with relationships with other conversations that are going on either historically or simultaneously. And so sometimes when we choose to use a particular word to refer to someone, for example, if we choose to say lone wolf or terrorist, that gets a lot of different meanings by the ways that those phrases interact with other conversations that are going out there. And so they can have a pretty big impact. For example, lone wolf, oftentimes, people have brought up issues with respect to race. There are lots of stereotypes about people who commit lone wolf acts, and or whatever we call them, lone wolf acts of terror. But oftentimes we characterize and even stereotype lone wolf people that commit those types of acts as white men.
And a wolf is kind of a majestic, powerful creature. It's kind of interesting that there's, I pick up on like hints of romanticism when we use the term wolf to describe, a person who's a murderer.
Sure, it's interesting because that can invoke other types of feelings like that. Another way to think about it, though, is that oftentimes when, say, law enforcement uses the term lone wolf, they have a relational aspect in mind, but that typically is a vertical relationship, because typically when they say lone wolf actor, they mean that someone necessarily wasn't taking commands from someone else. But another way to think about it is how it positions that person with respect to other people in society more in a horizontal dimension. And when we think about the people oftentimes that are ascribed as lone wolf actors, and especially when race is involved, that tends to allow us to think of these people as exceptional, somebody that's different than everything else, than everybody else. And especially if lone wolf tends to be ascribed to someone who's white, in the context of discourses that exist where we tend to stereotype other people, for example, African-American men, as being violent, then we tend to create this discourse where white men are exceptional. They do this thing on their own, but we don't need to necessarily worry. It's not sort of a thing that cuts across more than just this one individual who's different than everybody else.
Mm. I now want to bring in someone who can help us unpack the context of the Las Vegas shooting and our language around it. That's Grant Dewey. He's an author of A History, Mass Shootings in the U.S. Grant, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the program.
Grant, as you've been listening, and when you hear the word modern in the context of worst modern mass shooting in modern history, what does that mean to you?
Well, while I think the news media could make it seem less like a competition, I would argue that a lot of the onus falls on us. It falls on the public. That since the inception of the penny press in the 19th century, we've seen that the public has long shown that it's interested in news about violent, sensational crimes. And in order to survive in a competitive industry, news organizations frequently give the public what it wants. And kind of along the same lines, we often want to know whether a problem is getting worse. Is the problem increasing? Is it becoming more deadly? So the news media is reporting about whether a mass shooting is record-setting or not is part and parcel of our interest in knowing whether we need to do something about a problem because it is getting worse.
You know, one of the things I thought about while you were saying that is, do you think that it is what people want, or is it what they react to? Like, there's a difference. Sometimes our actions betray our desires, right?
Right.
In preparation for this show, I struggled myself about how to frame the event in Las Vegas. Like, I phrased it that way once. And that felt a little too removed and not specific enough. But on the other hand, something like the shooting murder of 58 individuals and the suicide of the shooter feels accurate, but kind of clinical and wordy. Is there a way that you wish, Grant, people in the media would frame these events?
Well, one of the things that I think that we've seen, at least over the last 5 to 10 years, is some of my colleagues who have done research on the topic have said that there's mass confusion over the phrase mass shooting. And I would agree with that. And mainly because what we've seen is these different definitions that people have come up with for mass shootings. And there have been a lot of different prevalence estimates that range anywhere from the single digits to more than 300 or 400 per year. And so for the public who doesn't dive deeply into this issue like people like I do, it could be very confusing. And so one of the things that I've usually talked to journalists about when I receive calls after a horrific mass shooting is that is to try to impart knowledge that mass shooting is really a new phrase for an old and familiar problem. Because prior to the 2000s, we were referring to these incidents as mass murders. But both mass murder and mass shooting are not very precise, because in fact the problems resulting from this lack of precision have been on display after last year's attack in Orlando and after last week's attack in Las Vegas, in which the news media have called these the worst mass shootings in American history. And then we have some on social media who have taken umbrage at that. So what we see, though, is that the types of cases that have really defined the essence of both mass murder and more recently mass shootings are what I've long referred to as mass public shootings. And these are incidents in which four or more victims are killed with a gun at a public location in the absence of other criminal activity. And when we look at the history of mass public shootings, what's interesting is that one of the first that occurred in American history took place in 1903 in Winfield, Kansas, and it was committed by a man named Gilbert Twigg, and it was at a musical concert, and he killed 9 and wounded 25. And you know, from that time all the way up through Las Vegas last week, we see that these mass public shootings have long been the ones that have galvanized the public and engendered a lot of fear, anger, and concern.
And Phil, when you hear a phrase like mass public shooting, does that feel more precise to you, or does that feel something that's a little bit more distant or something in between?
Well, as you mentioned, the term mass, when it's applied to these types of events, sometimes has technical definitions depending on who's actually using the term. But for the average speaker, it's incredibly ambiguous, and it's oftentimes deployed imprecisely as well. Another interesting thing about that phrase is that we do have a term for that particular type of mass murder. We don't have something like mass knifing. We don't have something like mass pipe bombing. And so we use these interesting structures also to reify certain processes and events as well, like shootings as well. So both aspects of that have their own interesting complexities and potential problems.
Can you tell me a little bit more about like how you're thinking about that? Like why do you think it is that from a language perspective or a cognitive point of view, we don't talk about mass pipe bombings, mass airline murder, you know?
Well, I mean, that's something that I wouldn't really necessarily say I'd be prepared to fully answer. More of it's just an interesting point that we choose when we talk about, we have mass murder, and as was just mentioned, mass shootings were typically referred to as mass murders prior to a certain time period, but we want to signal out shooting as something that's important enough to give it its own name. And it's these types of, it's not just words, but also structures and types of processes that help us to reify certain events like this. Famously, nominalization, like an example, like the word shooting is one of these types of things.
Mm-hmm. And Grant, you were telling us earlier about one of the first mass shootings that at least you looked at. Can you tell us a little bit about your work and how, you know, how you went to, why you were inspired to look at this, and what were the confines of how you began to define the parameters of, you know, that investigation?
Right. When I first became interested in this topic, it was back in the 1990s, and in fact, it was after a string of highly publicized mass public shootings occurred in the fall of 1991. And in response to those, I asked the question like most I imagine did, is why would someone want to go into their place of work and try to kill as many people as possible? Why would someone want to go into a school and try to kill as many people as possible? So initially, I was interested in the question of why. That, however, has been the most difficult one to answer, and it's been the one that's been most elusive. But as my work illustrates, my interests have kind of shifted over the years, because at that time, it was widely assumed that mass murder was this historically new phenomenon that emerged in the mid-1960s. And so one of the things that I was interested in looking at is whether that claim was actually true. And what I found through my research is that mass murder clearly existed prior to the mid-1960s. In fact, there was a mass murder wave in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s. And so really my work kind of evolved over time to look at these other issues that may not answer the why, but certainly add some context to recent events that we've been experiencing.
That's interesting. Can you give us some examples of that context and what you gleaned from it?
Well, just for example, looking at the patterns and prevalence of mass killings and focusing especially on mass public shootings, because as I mentioned, these are the types of events that have long galvanized the public, and they've really defined the essence of both the mass murder problem and the mass shooting problem. But what's important for people to understand is that whether we're talking about mass murder or even mass shooting, the mass public shootings are very rare within either context, because mass public shootings make up less than 20% of all mass shootings, and they make up a little more than 10% of all mass killings. So this type of violence that we focus on really kind of is very rare within the context of the words that we use to describe it.
But given how rare it is, you were also suggesting that even, you know, at the beginning of the 19th century, these kind of events really galvanized people to some kind of action or outrage across time. Is it just simply because they're both an attack on lives, but also like social fabric and essentially the social contract?
Well, I think one of the reasons, or several reasons, why mass public shootings have always been so newsworthy is because they are perceived as random, that the people who are the victims of these attacks, that they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think a lot of people can identify with the victims in these attacks. They think that could have been me, or that could have been my spouse, that could have been my child, that could have been my parent. And one thing that we've seen, at least recently too, with mass public shootings, is that there's frequently coverage, whether it's people are recording it as it's going live, and even prior to the advent of like the iPhone and so on, that there are often eyewitnesses to these attacks, and so it provides the news media with the opportunity to deliver a grim but fascinating account to the public.
Because it's public, it's much more vivid. / There's more primary sources to use to elaborate on the story.
Correct, because when we look at mass murder, for example, the by far the most common type of mass killing is when a senior head of the household kills his spouse or partner and children, and then often commits suicide afterwards.
And you use the word, you know, the gender pronoun he there. Is it predominantly male, or is that like an accident or intentional there?
No, it's predominantly male, and that's almost 95% of all mass killings are committed by males. But even when we look at familicide, it's more than 90% commit familicide, and so even with those cases, the vast majority take place within the privacy of the home, and usually there are no survivors to tell the public or tell police exactly what happened.
Grant, you were mentioning a wave of mass murders in the 20s and 30s that you uncovered. And I remember even from my youth, and you were referring to this when you started to look into this question in a kind of serious way. In my youth, I feel like I heard more stories about like workplace shootings. But today I feel that the motives seem to be more ideologically based. Is that just, you know, my offhand perception, or throughout time have you noticed different kinds of, you know, mass public murders that are committed for different reasons at different times?
Well, I don't know if I would say that they're necessarily more ideological. I mean, just because, like I mentioned, with the Winfield, Kansas massacre in 1903, that took place at a musical concert, much like the one that we just saw last week in Las Vegas. But I will say that that we do see an ebb and a flow to mass public shootings. There were, for example, more workplace shootings in the 1980s and 1990s, and then for a period of time, it seemed like there were more school shootings. So it does fluctuate.
Mm-hmm. You know, Grant, in a historical context, that there have been periods where these mass public murders have been more or less frequent. Have you been able to find kind of anything that suggests why that frequency has increased?
No, not to this point. One of the points that I tried to make, I wrote a piece that appeared in Politico last week, and one of the things that I tried to make is that we have yet to invest in any kind of solutions, if they exist, for this problem. And we invest in solutions for things like tornadoes, which have been about as deadly as mass shootings since the mid-1970s, but we don't do the same for this type of mass violence. And I don't think that we should ever really expect to know why these take place or know whether there are any kind of preventative solutions that we can implement until we actually invest in the funding that it takes to fully research this issue.
And Grant, in the meantime, how do you hope that we all talk about and think about talking about events like this when they happen? Phil.
I think the main thing is that we really do think reflectively about the words and choices that we use and understand that they do have an effect and understand that they do have a lot of different meanings that they can bring into a discussion like this. So one thing is we just can't simply repeat and recycle phrases that we hear over and again, but we have to think a little bit more deeply about what we say.
Phil Duncan, linguist at KU, thank you so much for sharing your time and experience with us this morning.
Thank you.
And Grant Dewey, he's an author of A History, Mass Shootings in the U.S. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
We now have a rough idea about how adults think about and talk about mass public murder, but how do we talk to kids about safety, especially in the context of these kinds of events? That's the conversation when KCUR Central Standard returns in just a moment. How do we talk to children about what's happened, and how do we prepare them for a world where deadly shootings are a reality? We want to hear your experiences. How do you talk to kids about this? You can join us by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can interact with us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. We're going to start our conversation with Captain Jeff Gilmore. You are the site base manager for Kansas City Public School District. Tell me about what that job entails.
Well, it entails quite a bit. We have 34 schools, and we have security officers in the majority of those schools. And we go through an intake process in the morning times and in the dismissal lunch duty. And my officers are, I say my because I take possession of it. They're in the schools to make sure that the school is safe, the students are safe, the teachers and administrators are safe.
Mm-hmm. And so those are officers who are KC Police Department officers, but they're assigned to the public schools. So they have all the other training that other officers have, but they're within the, like, their job every morning is to report to the school. Is that correct? Or do I have that off?
You have that off.
Okay.
These are officers that are employed by the school district. Mm-hmm. And that is their job, to report to the schools every year. They have a local site that they report to, a building, and that's where they go every day.
Mm-hmm. And so what do these active shooter trainings look like at schools, and what's your role in helping facilitate them?
Well, everybody has a role, administrators, teachers, custodians, my officers as well. We have a contract with Strategos International. The school district entered a contract with them, and they provide the active shooter training for the teachers, the administrators, and especially the security officers. And everyone does something different when it comes to the training aspect. Classrooms, the doors are always locked. They have paper over the windows. They have ropes, apparatuses that they can lock their door. If they shut it, they can lock it and secure the door so it cannot be opened from the outside. the entry doors are secured to make sure those are locked. People go around and check those to make sure those are locked, and then they get to a safe space. The security officers are doing the same. They're making sure students are getting into classrooms. If they can't get into a classroom, we can put them in a restroom, lock the bathroom door, and then everybody does their particular role.
And so what is your objective? Like, if a school were to do this perfectly, what does that even look like?
Well, when we do the drills, you're not doing the drill to say, aha, I got you. It took you 51 seconds to do this, and you should do it in 45. Mm-hmm. You look at where you can get better the next time. That's the purpose of the drill.
Mm-hmm. And so at a district level, what does that kind of look like in terms of coordinating all of this? Like, does the whole district go through this at once, or do you go through each school one at a time?
We go through Strategos International. They will actually come out and do a supervised drill at a school, which is state law. You have to do at least one a year. And they will come out and do that supervised drill. But they will also come out during the course of the school year and try to enter your building without security. Try to find an open door. Try to come through and don't present ID. Try to come through and get a weapon into the building as well.
Hmm. And when the active shooter trainings happen, does the school population know that they're about to happen? Or is like the point of the drill, it could happen at any time?
It could happen at any time.
Hmm. And, you know, I grew up when these drills were in their infancy. I was in junior high when Columbine happened. Have these trainings changed over time, like the ways that we, you know, implement them and think about them?
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned Columbine. Things changed with that. At that time, the schools just locked down and they waited for PD or help to come. Now you lock down. We have, I don't want to give away too much, but we have measures in place that if there's an active shooter, we have officers that are trained to go and, just to put it bluntly, eliminate the threat.
Mm-hmm. And that's been something that's been added on. And is that something that's changed because of different events? Like, how have people's thinking evolved around how we keep children safe in schools?
Well, you have to, like I said earlier, don't wait. If you have the capability and you have the training to go and eliminate the threat, go and do that.
Mm-hmm. And do students and faculty have questions for you or for like your officers before or after these drills?
Well, quite frankly, I am not in a school, so I can't answer that question, but I would imagine they would.
Do the officers you supervise, do they have questions and that kind of thing?
Yeah. They want to make sure if they see something that's wrong, they've seen something that didn't go the way it's supposed to go, they will say, well, why did this happen? We need to do this. We need to get that information to everyone so the next time you don't do it that way, you do it the proper way.
Hmm. Captain Gilmore, I want you to stay with us for a moment, but I want to bring in Erin Hambrick. She's an assistant professor of psychology at UMKC, a clinical child psychologist whose research focuses on child trauma. Erin, thank you so much for making the time for us today.
Absolutely.
And so as we just heard, you know, sometimes the people who administer the drills can have questions about, you know, how these things should work. What are some of the things that you think about in terms of like questions that maybe adults could be asking kids?
You know, I'm really glad that we're talking about this preparedness component, because I think that any disaster has three phases. You have your preparedness phase, your crisis response phase, and then your recovery phase. And you use similar strategies in all of those phases. And when you are thinking about how to prepare children for a potential school shooting or a shooter intruding, you want to think about using words with them that are honest and that don't elevate the concern and that also promote a sense of safety, and that you're also collaborating with them regarding what their questions and concerns may be. I think that at times it can be difficult to think, what's a child going to wonder in this situation, or even what's a teacher going to wonder once the training has already begun, or once the drill has already begun, but to be prepared to process that a lot on the back end, and also letting people know that something they need to be prepared for is that they might have thoughts, feelings, and questions that are a bit surprising to them while the drill is ongoing.
Yeah, and want to remind folks that if you've been talking to kids about safety, about active shooter training, and how we want to know how you're having those conversations, you can join us by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can interact with us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Aaron, you know, as I've been listening to Captain Gilmore, I've been thinking about, like, the very act of making my mind prepare for, you know, that kind of event, it makes me anxious. Mm-hmm. Maybe that says something about me, but is there a difference? Like, is there a difference between trauma and anxiety? And, like, what's the relationship between those things, particularly as we think about children, you know, who might be more susceptible and don't necessarily have the same, you know, coping supports around them that adults may have?
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about when someone is anticipating an event that could happen?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think per child, perceptions of what could be traumatic per se can differ. And some children certainly would consider even preparing for the potential of a shooting to be traumatic. But I do think that it's important to remember that when we are preparing someone for something potentially traumatic, that we want to always be going about it with a sense of calm, because we don't know for which children talking about it might actually be traumatic versus which children just might have a little bit of anxiety but not be too concerned about it. And so really instilling a sense of safety in all children is very important, making it clear to children that adults are going to be the ones who are in charge of the drill if you're doing it at drill at school, for example, and letting children think of ways that they can cope with the drill. Again, because you're going to have a spectrum of some children who think it's quite traumatic, have had an experience like that before, versus children who might even think it's funny and not being taking it very seriously. And so talking with children about what's your strategy going to be while we are in the room with the paper over the windows. Are you going to sing a song in your head? Are you going to count to 10? Are you going to think of something that you enjoy? What is each individual child going to do in that moment?
Mm. And Captain Gilmore, you were nodding your head as you were listening. What were you thinking about there?
How important it is, you know, to get the students prepared even before, during, and after the event.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, sorry, go on. I once heard a therapist say that trauma is what happens to someone after an event. In other words, different people may have different responses to the same mm-hmm. event. Are you concerned that kids or adults could experience trauma through this kind of training, Aaron?
You know, I think it's a potential that people would want to keep in mind and to conduct these in ways that are not going to have a strong potential for traumatization. But also, I think that sometimes when we think about children, we think, I can't say the word shooting because it's going to traumatize them. Well, they're hearing it on the news. They are hearing their friends talk about it. And so to a certain extent, hearing an adult talk about it in a safe and calm manner, without kind of losing their minds over it, but keeping their cool, can actually be a way to instill safety and let kids know we are prepared here in this school. Here is our plan. Here's what the adults are doing to ensure your safety, and to use it more therapeutically than as a way to scare everyone. In fact, I would wonder what the impact on children would be if they saw all of this on the media and heard about school shootings and nobody talked about it at school and the kinds of questions it might be running through their mind.
Right. Like, nobody's prepared. Clearly, yeah. No one is thinking about this.
Yeah. I mean, I once worked with a child who we were just doing a therapeutic group in a place where tornadoes were common. And the third time they said to me, when's the tornado drill coming? I looked at them and said, it sounds like you'd like to know where to go if there's a tornado. And we got to walk through that. And that was a good moment for us instead of one that that further raised anxiety. Children are thinking about these things and they want to know that adults have a plan.
Are you referring to the work that you did in Joplin there? Or is this...
You know, just other children that I've worked with in therapeutic settings, but certainly my work in Joplin, I think, really informed my thinking in terms of the fact that when we talk about trauma, we really shouldn't necessarily think of it as re-traumatizing, because the trauma itself was what was traumatizing. Mm. And we don't want to minimize what trauma actually is by being afraid to talk about words that are associated with it. And being too afraid to have those conversations, we make it larger than it should be.
Yeah. So how would you suggest starting a conversation like this with a young person?
It would depend on if the young person had themselves experienced a trauma or if you were just thinking about preparedness. And when we think about the general public who we are more concerning ourselves with preparedness, we would want to be direct. So if we were starting if we knew that there would be the potential in a school term for there to be some sort of drill related to mass shootings, we would want to introduce it to children and say, this year we're going to be having trainings and drills. And one of them might involve what to do if a shooter were to enter the building. And then to potentially ask children what questions they have about why they are doing that drill and what their role is in the drill. Children really need to know their role in things. And if we don't tell them directly, when this happened, my role is to keep everyone safe. Your role is to stay quiet, think of the way that you're going to cope with the moment in your mind, whether it's singing your song, whether it's looking out. Looking at your friend in the classroom and programming them to have a job so that they can focus on keeping themselves safe instead of all of the what ifs.
It also kind of sounds to me like the adult needs to be at a place where they're not anxious as well.
It's a really important thing to me. And so many times people ask me, what should we say to children who have faced trauma? And to me, 90% of it is what you show. And if you are showing anxiety and if you are suddenly using a different tone of voice than you use every day and you're being hushed when normally you are bright and bubbly, children will pick up on that and they will think that they are in much more danger than they are.
On the other hand, there's something about that feels a little counterintuitive to me, in the sense that if you are, you know, the subject matter is kind of heavy and it's serious. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a bright, cheery disposition might be, you know, incongruous with like the message that you're trying to send.
Sure.
But so tell me a little bit more.
Yeah. I think the choice of the term bright probably wasn't the best term. You know, I think that it's fine to show children that this is an event that we take seriously and that that you're not making jokes about it. Right. Because there's a really big difference between making jokes about something and letting children know that something is important, but also not using terms that overstate the danger, not saying this is a really frightening thing that some people go through, a horrifying event, but saying some schools have had shooters that enter the building. We want to be prepared, and this is how we're going to be prepared, and being clear that there's a plan.
Well, Aaron Hambrick and Gil and Captain Gilmore, stay with us. When we come back, we'll be getting to your calls. How do you talk about, how do you talk to kids about safety? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. KCUR Central Standard returns in just a moment. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, in for Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm here with Captain Jeff Gilmore, Assistant Director of Site-Based Manager for the Kansas City Public School District, and Erin Hambrick. She's an Assistant Professor of Psychology at UMKC. And we welcome your perspectives and questions. How are you talking to kids about safety today? Call 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us online at KCUR. CST. So, Aaron, you got thinking about trauma with children, particularly with research you did in Joplin. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. So we were very interested about a year after the Joplin tornado in understanding the role that parents play in shaping and forming children's perceptions of trauma. And so we know that it's very common for people to discuss trauma in the aftermath, especially when it's a disaster, an event that's been experienced by many different people. There's lots of social sharing in the aftermath. That's quite normal, and it's actually a way that parents can promote coping in children, talking to children about their emotions, helping them think about, and then what did we do to stay safe? Do you remember who helped us? And to kind of help children remember the meaning that they might have made through that experience. And so what we did was meet with about 50 parents and their children and actually just have them provide recollections of the tornado and also some parent-child conversations about the tornado. And interestingly, one of the things that we learned was that about a year post-tornado, the children who still had the most to say about what happened to them and the children and families whose conversations were still quite long were the children who weren't doing very well still, which led us really to believe that.
How were you assessing what well means?
We were looking at measures of post-traumatic stress disorder. So children with PTSD would be very hypervigilant, would tend to be avoidant, especially in that situation of trauma triggers related to the tornado. We also looked at measures of anxiety, separation anxiety, can they be away from their parents, and even depression and low mood.
Mm-hmm. And so you were saying that you found that kids who were essentially ruminating on the event more and more and more, even a year afterwards, were the ones who... There was a correlation between that kind of behavior and the PTSD symptoms.
Yes, absolutely. And so I like that you use the word ruminating because that's one hypothesis we have. We can't be conclusive about what we learned in that study because it wasn't a longitudinal study. But what we are wondering is if there's a certain point that talking about it becomes too much and it's time to start redirecting and helping children think toward the future. Sometimes when we think about what to do for children after the trauma, we focus so much on talking about it that we focus very little on how to get on with one's life and how to find meaning in the current day to day.
And that's interesting to me because it sounds like what you were saying earlier is like we need to talk about mm-hmm. these kind of things. Mm-hmm. But then there becomes a point mm-hmm. where we actually kind of need to pull back or is it a talk about, but talk about in a different way? Help me understand that subtle distinction.
I like that we're talking about this because I think this is an area where we need a lot more research and work, but we certainly are learning that there might be a difference in how we prepare and how we talk to children in the immediate aftermath and how we talk about these events long-term with children. And I do think that in the beginning, we need to make sure that children clearly understand what happened and what didn't happen so that their perceptions of the event are valid, that we are making sure they don't have unanswered questions. But there might be a point in the long-term recovery when if this memory is still so central to the child's functioning, that we might want to think about ways to either talk about it differently or to help redirect and resume a focus on the future and routine and getting the child back engaged with the activities of daily living that really are the thing we're trying to protect when we focus on preparedness.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn to Drew in St. Joseph. Drew, welcome to Central Standard.
How I talk to my child about this, I guess even the mass shooting, the recent hurricanes, all the flooding over stuff is look for the helpers. It's the Mr. Rogers perspective, we always say, and it's there's always people out there helping, and there's always people that need the help, and there's horrible people out there, yes, but there's always people out there helping when the time comes, and be prepared to help and be prepared to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, they're out there working hard and stuff, and not to be scared, I guess. You know, that's some of the main stuff.
And Drew, what's been the kids you've been talking with, like, what's their response?
Really positive, actually. My son, he just turned six. He's a wonderful little boy, and he has a great mind on him. And I'm always afraid that this kind of stuff's going to shape him different. And yeah, he's really positive, and he just looks at his, those are the rules. Explain to him that there's the superheroes, and those are the ones that are out there that are going. You know, the first responders that have to go and situation immediately, or it's the people afterwards that are throwing a sandbag or, you know, or up with a shovel or something. You know, the helpers are there, you know, that we don't focus on them enough, that there's, we focus on the bad so much that, so we don't look around and go, hey, look around here. And that's what we call the, I guess it's the Mr. Rogers. He had a kind of a perspective on that. They always look for the helpers, you know, and that's something I always remember as a kid, you know.
It sounds like it's
a thing to pass on, I guess.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Drew. It sounds like the very conversations that Mr. Rogers was having with you, him through the television, are something that really informed him. And Aaron, it sounds like these conversations are things that can stick with you through your whole life, as they did for Drew, and now it's passing on to his kids. Mm-hmm. And Captain Gilmore, did you hear anything in what Drew was saying that you know, resonated with the objectives that you have when you're preparing students for these kind of events?
Well, I would like to add something that I think is very important that I failed to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
KCPS, Kansas City Public Schools, has another approach as well. We have Dr. Luis Cordobo. He's the chief of student support services, and under his command is director of behavioral services. And we offer 5 social workers and 2 family support specialists. So if an adult, a teacher, administrator, or one of the students who are having difficulties because of the training aspect and what things that they heard, the teachers, the counselors, and whatnot could refer that student, along with that student parents, to one of these individuals, and they could seek out help. Mm-hmm. They could send them in the right direction to find the guidance that they needed. With the district employee assistant program, if an employee had an issue, they would have someone to turn to receive the help and the guidance and the counseling they needed to let them know that everything is going to be all right with this issue.
Mm-hmm. And for you, Captain Gilmore, what's the most rewarding part of this work that you do?
Well, I chose to come work for the district. I graduated from the district. I won't give the year, but I retired and I took a weekend off to come work for the district, and it's been rewarding. Challenging, but it's very rewarding.
Well, thank you so much. That's all the time that we have. Captain Jeff Gilmore, Assistant Director, Site-Based Manager for the Kansas City Public School District. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Aaron Hambrick, Assistant Professor of Psychology at UMKC. You're a clinical child psychologist whose research focuses on child trauma. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Yes.
And you can continue this conversation on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. My handle is at MLM Industries. To listen back to this conversation or any others, you can head to kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, we'll look at how shows make it to Broadway, and there'll be more. Tune in. The show is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tutto, Jen Chen, Suzanne Hogan, and myself. Our intern is Tom Taylor. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. Up to Date is next, so stick around.